Judging from the validation loss, this setup isn't as good as the regularized GRU alone, but it's significantly faster. It looks at twice as much data, which in this case doesn't appear to be hugely helpful, but may be important for other datasets. Section 6.4.5. Wrapping up. Here's what you should take away from this section. In the same way that 2D ConvNets perform well for processing visual patterns in 2D space, 1D ConvNets perform well for processing temporal patterns. They offer a faster alternative to RNNs on some problems, in particular natural language processing tasks. Typically, 1D ConvNets are structured much like their 2D equivalents from the world of computer vision. They consist of stacks of Conv1D layers and max pooling 1D layers, ending in a global pooling operation or flattening operation. Because RNNs are extremely expensive for processing very long sequences, but 1D ConvNets are cheap, it can be a good idea to use a 1D ConvNet as a pre-processing step before an RNN, shortening the sequence and extracting useful representations for the RNN to process. Chapter summary. In this chapter, you learned the following techniques, which are widely applicable to any dataset of sequence data, from text to time series. How to tokenize text, what word embeddings are, and how to use them, what recurrent networks are, and how to use them, how to stack RNN layers and use bidirectional RNNs to build more powerful sequence processing models, how to use 1D ConvNets for sequence processing, how to combine 1D ConvNets and RNNs to process long sequences. You can use RNNs for time series regression, predicting the future, time series classification, anomaly detection in time series, and sequence labeling, such as identifying names or dates in sentences. Similarly, you can use 1D ConvNets for machine translation, sequence-to-sequence convolutional models like SliceNet, document classification, and spelling correction. Footnote. See this URL. If global order matters in your sequence data, then it's preferable to use a recurrent network to process it. This is typically the case for time series, where the recent past is likely to be more informative than the distant past. If global ordering isn't fundamentally meaningful, then 1D ConvNets will turn out to work at least as well and are cheaper. This is often the case for text data, where a keyword found at the beginning of a sentence is just as meaningful as a keyword found at the end. Chapter 7. Advanced Deep Learning Best Practices. This chapter covers the Keras Functional API, using Keras callbacks, working with the TensorBoard visualization tool, important best practices for developing state-of-the-art models. This chapter explores a number of powerful tools that will bring you closer to being able to develop state-of-the-art models on difficult problems. Using the Keras Functional API, you can build graph-like models, share a layer across different inputs, and use Keras models just like Python functions. Keras callbacks and the TensorBoard browser-based visualization tool let you monitor models during training. We'll also discuss several other best practices, including batch normalization, residual connections, hyperparameter optimization, and model ensembling. Section 7.1. Going beyond the sequential model. The Keras Functional API. Until now, all neural networks introduced in this book have been implemented using the sequential model. The sequential model makes the assumption that the network has exactly one input and exactly one output, and that it consists of a linear stack of layers. See Figure 7.1. This is a commonly verified assumption. The configuration is so common that we've been able to cover many topics and practical applications in these pages so far using only the sequential model class. But this set of assumptions is too inflexible in a number of cases. Some networks require several independent inputs. Others require multiple outputs. And some networks have internal branching between layers that make them look like graphs of layers rather than linear stacks of layers. Some tasks, for instance, require multimodal inputs. They merge data coming from different input sources, processing each type of data using different kinds of neural layers. Imagine a deep learning model trying to predict the most likely market price of a second-hand piece of clothing, using the following inputs. User-provided metadata, such as the item's brand, age, and so on. A user-provided text description, and a picture of the item. If you had only the metadata available, you could one-hot encode it and use a densely connected network to predict the price. If you had only the text description available, you could use an RNN or 1D ConvNet. If you had only the picture, you could use a 2D ConvNet. But how can you use all three at the same time? A naive approach would be to train three separate models and then do a weighted average of their predictions. But this may be suboptimal, because the information extracted by the models may be redundant. A better way is to jointly learn a more accurate model of the data by using a model that can see all available input modalities simultaneously. A model with three input branches. See figure 7.2. Similarly, some tasks need to predict multiple target attributes of input data. Given the text of a novel or short story, you might want to automatically classify it by genre, such as romance or thriller, but also predict the approximate date it was written. Of course, you could train two separate models, one for the genre and one for the date. But because these attributes aren't statistically independent, you could build a better model by learning to jointly predict both genre and date at the same time. Such a joint model would then have two outputs, or heads. See figure 7.3. Due to correlation between genre and date, knowing the date of a novel would help the model learn rich, accurate representations of the space of novel genres, and vice versa. Additionally, many recently developed neural architectures require nonlinear network topology. Networks structured as directed acyclic graphs. The Inception family of networks, developed by Shegedy et al. At Google, for instance, relies on inception modules, where the input is processed by several parallel convolutional branches whose outputs are then merged back into a single tensor. See figure 7.4. There's also the recent trend of adding residual connections to a model, which started with the ResNet family of networks, developed by Hay et al. At Microsoft. A residual connection consists of re-injecting previous representations into the downstream flow of data by adding a past output tensor to a later output tensor. See figure 7.5, which helps prevent information loss along the data processing flow. There are many other examples of such graph-like networks. Footnote. Christian Shegedy et al. Going Deeper with Convolutions. Conference on Computer Vision and Pattern Recognition 2014 at this URL. Footnote. Kaming Hay et al. Deep Residual Learning for Image Recognition. Conference on Computer Vision and Pattern Recognition 2015 at this URL. These three important use cases, multi-input models, multi-output models and graph-like models, aren't possible when using only the sequential model class in Keras. But there's another far more general and flexible way to use Keras. The functional API. This section explains in detail what it is, what it can do, and how to use it. Section 7.1.1. Introduction to the functional API. In the functional API, you directly manipulate tensors and you use layers as functions that take tensors and return tensors, hence the name functional API. Let's start with a minimal example that shows side by side a simple sequential model and its equivalent in the functional API. This is what the call to model.summary displays. The only part that may seem a bit magical at this point is instantiating a model object using only an input tensor and an output tensor. Behind the scenes, Keras retrieves every layer involved in going from input_tensor to output_tensor, bringing them together into a graph-like data structure, a model. Of course, the reason it works is that output_tensor was obtained by repeatedly transforming input_tensor. If you tried to build a model from inputs and outputs that weren't related, you'd get a runtime error. This error tells you, in essence, that Keras couldn't reach input_1 from the provided output tensor. When it comes to compiling, training, or evaluating such an instance of model, the API is the same as that of sequential. Section 7.1.2. Multi-input models. The functional API can be used to build models that have multiple inputs. Typically, such modules at some point merge their different input branches using a layer that can combine several tensors by adding them, concatenating them, and so on. This is usually done via a Keras merge operation such as keras.layers.add, keras.layers.concatenate, and so on. Let's look at a very simple example of a multi-input model, a question-answering model. A typical question-answering model has two inputs: a natural language question and a text snippet, such as a news article, providing information to be used for answering the question. The model must then produce an answer. In the simplest possible setup, this is a one-word answer obtained via a softmax over some predefined vocabulary. See figure 7.6. Following is an example of how you can build such a model with the functional API. You set up two independent branches, encoding the text input and the question input as representation vectors, then concatenate these vectors, and finally add a softmax classifier on top of the concatenated representations. Now, how do you train this two-input model? There are two possible APIs. You can feed the model a list of NumPy arrays as inputs, or you can feed it a dictionary that maps input names to NumPy arrays. Naturally, the latter option is available only if you give names to your inputs. Section 7.1.3. Multi-output models. In the same way, you can use the functional API to build models with multiple outputs, or multiple heads. A simple example is a network that attempts to simultaneously predict different properties of the data, such as a network that takes as input a series of social media posts from a single anonymous person and tries to predict attributes of that person, such as age, gender, and income level. See figure 7.7. Importantly, training such a model requires the ability to specify different loss functions for different heads of the network. For instance, age prediction is a scalar regression task, but gender prediction is a binary classification task requiring a different training procedure. But because gradient descent requires you to minimize a scalar, you must combine these losses into a single value in order to train the model. The simplest ways to combine different losses is to sum them all. In Keras, you can use either a list or a dictionary of losses in compile to specify different objects for different outputs. The resulting loss values are summed into a global loss, which is minimized during training. Note that very imbalanced loss contributions will cause the model representations to be optimized preferentially for the task with the largest individual loss, at the expense of the other tasks. To remedy this, you can assign different levels of importance to the loss values in their contribution to the final loss. This is useful, in particular, if the losses values use different scales. For instance, the mean squared error, MSE, loss, used for the age regression task, typically takes a value around 3 to 5, whereas the cross-entropy loss used for the gender classification task can be as low as 0.1. In such a situation, to balance the contribution of the different losses, you can assign a weight of 10 to the cross-entropy loss and a weight of 0.25 to the MSE loss. Much as in the case of multi-input models, you can pass NumPy data to the model for training either via a list of arrays or via a dictionary of arrays. Section 7.1.4. Directed acyclic graphs of layers. With the functional API, not only can you build models with multiple inputs and multiple outputs, but you can also implement networks with a complex internal topology. Neural networks in Keras are allowed to be arbitrary, directed acyclic graphs of layers. The qualifier, acyclic, is important. These graphs can't have cycles. It's impossible for a tensor X to become the input of one of the layers that generated X. The only processing loops that are allowed, that is, recurrent connections, are those internal to recurrent layers. Several common neural network components are implemented as graphs. Two notable ones are inception modules and residual connections. To better understand how the functional API can be used to build a graph of layers, let's take a look at how you can implement both of them in Keras. Inception modules. Inception is a popular type of network architecture for convolutional neural networks. It was developed by Christian Szegedy and his colleagues at Google in 2013 to 2014, inspired by the earlier network-in-network architecture. It consists of a stack of modules that themselves look like small independent networks, split into several parallel branches. The most basic form of an inception module has 3 to 4 branches, starting with a 1x1 convolution, followed by a 3x3 convolution, and ending with a concatenation of the resulting features. This setup helps the network separately learn spatial features and channel-wise features, which is more efficient than learning them jointly. More complex versions of an inception module are also possible, typically involving pooling operations, different spatial convolution sizes, for example 5x5 instead of 3x3 on some branches, and branches without a spatial convolution, only a 1x1 convolution. An example of such a module, taken from inception version 3, is shown in figure 7.8. Footnote. See this URL. Footnote. Min Lin, Qian Chen, and Su Chen Yan. Network in Network. International Conference on Learning Representations 2013. At this URL. The purpose of 1x1 convolutions. You already know that convolutions extract spatial patches around every tile in an input tensor and apply the same transformation to each patch. An edge case is when the patches extracted consist of a single tile. The convolution operation then becomes equivalent to running each tile vector through a dense layer. It will compute features that mix together information from the channels instead of the input tensor, but it won't mix information across space because it's looking at one tile at a time. Such 1x1 convolutions, also called pointwise convolutions, are featured in inception modules, where they contribute to factoring out channel-wise feature learning and space-wise feature learning. A reasonable thing to do if you assume that each channel is highly autocorrelated across space, but different channels may not be highly correlated with each other. Here's how you'd implement the module featured in figure 7.8 using the functional API. This example assumes the existence of a 4D input tensor, X. Note that the full Inception V3 architecture is available in Keras as keras.applications.inception_v3.inception_v3, including weights pre-trained on the ImageNet dataset. Another closely related model available as part of the Keras application module is Exception. Exception, which stands for Extreme Inception, is a ConvNet architecture loosely inspired by Inception. It takes the idea of separating the learning of channel-wise and space-wise features to its logical extreme, and replaces Inception modules with depth-wise separable convolutions consisting of a depth-wise convolution, a spatial convolution where every input channel is handled separately, followed by a pointwise convolution, a one-by-one convolution, effectively an extreme form of an inception module where spatial features and channel-wise features are fully separated. Exception has roughly the same number of parameters as Inception V3, but it shows better runtime performance and higher accuracy on ImageNet as well as other large-scale datasets due to a more efficient use of model parameters. Footnote. François Chollet, Exception, Deep Learning with Depth-Wise Separable Convolutions, Conference on Computer Vision and Pattern Recognition 2017, at this URL. Residual connections. Residual connections are a common graph-like network component found in many post-2015 network architectures, including Exception. They were introduced by Hay et al. From Microsoft in their winning entry in the ILSVRC ImageNet Challenge in late 2015. They tackle two common problems that plague any large-scale deep learning model: vanishing gradients and representational bottlenecks. In general, adding residual connections to any model that has more than 10 layers is likely to be beneficial. Footnote. Hay et al., Deep Residual Learning for Image Recognition, at this URL. A residual connection consists of making the output of an earlier layer available as input to a later layer, effectively creating a shortcut in a sequential network. Rather than being concatenated to the later activation, the earlier output is summed with the later activation, which assumes that both activations are the same size. If they're different sizes, you can use a linear transformation to reshape the earlier activation into the target shape. For example, a dense layer without an activation, or, for convolutional feature maps, a one-by-one convolution without an activation. Here's how to implement a residual connection in Keras when the feature map sizes are the same using identity residual connections. This example assumes the existence of a 4D input tensor, X. And the following implements a residual connection when the feature map sizes differ using a linear residual connection, again assuming the existence of a 4D input tensor, X. Representational bottlenecks in deep learning. In a sequential model, each successive representation layer is built on top of the previous one, which means it only has access to information contained in the activation of the previous layer. If one layer is too small, for example, it has features that are too low-dimensional, then the model would be constrained by how much information can be crammed into the activations of this layer. You can grasp this concept with a signal processing analogy. If you have an audio processing pipeline that consists of a series of operations, each of which takes as input the output of the previous operation, then, if one operation crops your signal to a low frequency range, for example between 0 and 15 kHz, the operations downstream will never be able to recover the dropped frequencies. Any loss of information is permanent. Residual connections, by re-injecting earlier information downstream, partially solve this issue for deep learning models. Vanishing gradients in deep learning. Backpropagation, the master algorithm used to train deep neural networks, works by propagating a feedback signal from the output loss down to earlier layers. If this feedback signal has to be propagated through a deep stack of layers, the signal may become tenuous or even be lost entirely, rendering the network untrainable. This issue is known as vanishing gradients. This problem occurs both with deep networks and with recurrent networks over very long sequences. In both cases, a feedback signal must be propagated through a long series of operations. You're already familiar with the solution that the LSTM layer uses to address this problem in recurrent networks. It introduces a carry track that propagates information parallel to the main processing track. Residual connections work in a similar way in feed-forward deep networks, but they're even simpler. They introduce a purely linear information carry track parallel to the main layer stack, thus helping to propagate gradients through arbitrarily deep stacks of layers. Section 7.1.5. Layer weight sharing. One more important feature of the functional API is the ability to reuse a layer instance several times. When you call a layer instance twice, instead of instantiating a new layer for each call, you reuse the same weights with every call. This allows you to build models that have shared branches, several branches that all share the same knowledge and perform the same operations. That is, they share the same representations and learn these representations simultaneously for different sets of inputs. For example, consider a model that attempts to assess the semantic similarity between two sentences. The model has two inputs, the two sentences to compare, and outputs the score between 0 and 1, where 0 means unrelated sentences, and 1 means sentences that are either identical or reformulations of each other. Such a model could be useful in many applications, including deduplicating natural language queries in a dialogue system. In this setup, the two input sentences are interchangeable, because semantic similarity is a symmetrical relationship. The similarity of A to B is identical to the similarity of B to A. For this reason, it wouldn't make sense to learn two independent models for processing each input sentence. Rather, you want to process both with a single LSTM layer. The representations of this LSTM layer, its weights, are learned based on both inputs simultaneously. This is what we call a Siamese LSTM model, or a shared LSTM. Here's how to implement such a model using layered sharing, layer reuse, in the Keras functional API. Naturally, a layer instance may be used more than once. It can be called arbitrarily many times, reusing the same set of weights every time. Section 7.1.6. Models as layers. Importantly, in the functional API, models can be used as you'd use layers. Effectively, you can think of a model as a bigger layer. This is true of both the sequential and model classes. This means you can call a model on an input tensor and retrieve an output tensor. If the model has multiple input tensors and multiple output tensors, it should be called with a list of tensors. When you call a model instance, you're reusing the weights of the model, exactly like what happens when you call a layer instance. Calling an instance, whether it's a layer instance or a model instance, will always reuse the existing learned representations of the instance, which is intuitive. One simple practical example of what you can build by reusing a model instance is a vision model that uses a dual camera as its input. Two parallel cameras a few centimeters, 1 inch, apart. Such a model can perceive depth, which can be useful in many applications. You shouldn't need two independent models to extract visual features from the left camera and the right camera before merging the two feeds. Such low-level processing can be shared across the two inputs, that is, done via layers that use the same weights and thus share the same representations. Here's how you'd implement a Siamese vision model, shared convolutional base, in Keras. Section 7.1.7. Wrapping up. This concludes our introduction to the Keras functional API, an essential tool for building advanced deep neural network architectures. Now you know the following. To step out of the sequential API, whenever you need anything more than a linear stack of layers. How to build Keras models with several inputs, several outputs, and complex internal network topology using the Keras functional API. How to reuse the weights for layer or model across different processing branches by calling the same layer or model instance several times. Section 7.2. Inspecting and monitoring deep learning models using Keras callbacks and TensorBoard. In this section, we'll review ways to gain greater access to and control over what goes on inside your model during training. Launching a training run on a large dataset for tens of epochs using model.fit or model.fit_generator, can be a bit like launching a paper airplane. Past the initial impulse, you don't have any control over its trajectory or its landing spot. If you want to avoid bad outcomes, and thus wasted paper airplanes, it's smarter to use not a paper plane, but a drone, the consensus environment, send data back to its operator, and automatically make steering decisions based on its current state. The techniques we present here will transform the call to model.fit from a paper airplane into a smart, autonomous drone that can self-introspect and dynamically take action. Section 7.2.1. Using callbacks to act on a model during training. When you're training a model, there are many things you can't predict from the start. In particular, you can't tell how many epochs will be needed to get to an optimal validation loss. The examples so far have adopted the strategy of training for enough epochs that you begin overfitting, using the first run to figure out the proper number of epochs to train for, and then finally launching a new training run from scratch using this optimal number. Of course, this approach is wasteful. A much better way to handle this is to stop training when you measure that the validation loss is no longer improving. This can be achieved using a Keras callback. A callback is an object, a class instance implementing specific methods, that is passed to the model in the call to fit, and that is called by the model at various points during training. It has access to all the available data about the state of the model and its performance, and it can take action. Interrupt training, save a model, load a different weight set, or otherwise alter the state of the model. Here are some examples of ways you can use callbacks. Model checkpointing. Saving the current weights of the model at different points during training. Early stopping. Interrupting training when the validation loss is no longer improving. And of course, saving the best model obtained during training. Dynamically adjusting the value of certain parameters during training, such as the learning rate of the optimizer. Logging training and validation metrics during training, or visualizing the representations learned by the model as they're updated. The Keras progress bar that you're familiar with is a callback. The Keras.callbacks module includes a number of built-in callbacks. This is not an exhaustive list. Keras.callbacks.modelcheckpoint, Keras.callbacks.earlystopping, Keras.callbacks.learningRateScheduler, Keras.callbacks.reduceLROnPlateau, Keras.callbacks.csvlogger. Let's review a few of them to give you an idea of how to use them. Model checkpoint, early stopping, and reduce LR on plateau. The model checkpoint and early stopping callbacks. You can use the early stopping callback to interrupt training once a target metric being monitored has stopped improving for a fixed number of epochs. For instance, this callback allows you to interrupt training as soon as you start overfitting, thus avoiding having to retrain your model for a smaller number of epochs. This callback is typically used in combination with model checkpoint, which lets you continually save the model during training and, optionally, save only the current best model so far, the version of the model that achieved the best performance at the end of an epoch. The reduce LR on plateau callback. You can use this callback to reduce the learning rate when the validation loss has stopped improving. Reducing or increasing the learning rate in case of a lost plateau is an effective strategy to get out of local minima during training. The following example uses the reduce LR on plateau callback. Writing your own callback. If you need to take a specific action during training that isn't covered by one of the built-in callbacks, you can write your own callback. Callbacks are implemented by subclassing the class keras.callbacks.callback. You can then implement any number of the following transparently named methods, which are called at various points during training. These methods are all called with a logs argument, which is a dictionary containing information about the previous batch, epoch, or training run, training and validation metrics, and so on. Additionally, the callback has access to the following attributes. Self.model, the model instance from which the callback is being called. self.validation_data the value of what was passed to fit as validation data. Here is a simple example of a custom callback that saves to disk, as NumPy arrays, the activations of every layer of the model at the end of every epoch, computed on the first sample of the validation set. This is all you need to know about callbacks. The rest is technical details which you can easily look up. Now you're equipped to perform any sort of logging or pre-programmed intervention on a Keras model during training. Section 7.2.2. Introduction to TensorBoard. The TensorFlow Visualization Framework. To do good research or develop good models, you need rich, frequent feedback about what's going on inside your models during your experiments. That's the point of running experiments. To get information about how well a model performs, as much information as possible. Making progress is an iterative process or loop. You start with an idea and express it as an experiment, attempting to validate or invalidate your idea. You run this experiment and process the information it generates. This inspires your next idea. The more iterations of this loop you're able to run, the more refined and powerful your ideas become. Keras helps you go from idea to experiment in the least possible time, and fast GPUs can help you get from experiment to result as quickly as possible. But what about processing the experiment results? That's where TensorBoard comes in. This section introduces TensorBoard, a browser-based visualization tool that comes packaged with TensorFlow. Note that it's only available for Keras models when you're using Keras with the TensorFlow backend. The key purpose of TensorBoard is to help you visually monitor everything that goes on inside your model during training. If you're monitoring more information than just the model's final loss, you can develop a clearer vision of what the model does and doesn't do, and you can make progress more quickly. TensorBoard gives you access to several neat features all in your browser. Visually monitoring metrics during training, visualizing your model architecture, visualizing histograms of activations and gradients, exploring embeddings in 3D. Let's demonstrate these features on a simple example. You'll train a 1D ConvNet on the IMDb sentiment analysis task. The model is similar to the one you saw in the last section of Chapter 6. You'll consider only the top 2,000 words in the IMDb vocabulary to make visualizing word embeddings more tractable. Before you start using TensorBoard, you need to create a directory where you'll store the log files it generates. Let's launch the training with a TensorBoard callback instance. This callback will write log events to disk at the specified location. At this point, you can launch the TensorBoard server from the command line, instructing it to read the logs the callback is currently writing. The TensorBoard utility should have been automatically installed on your machine the moment you installed TensorFlow, for example via pip. You can then browse to this URL and look at your model training. See Figure 7.10. In addition to live graphs of the training and validation metrics, you get access to the Histograms tab, where you can find pretty visualizations of histograms of activation values taken by your layers. See Figure 7.11. The Embeddings tab gives you a way to inspect the embedding locations and spatial relationships of the 10,000 words in the input vocabulary as learned by the initial embedding layer. Because the embedding space is 128 dimensional, TensorBoard automatically reduces it to 2D or 3D using a dimensionality reduction algorithm of your choice. Either Principal Component Analysis, PCA, or T-Distributed Stochastic Neighbor Embedding, T-SNE. In Figure 7.12, in the point cloud, you can clearly see two clusters. Words with a positive connotation and words with a negative connotation. The visualization makes it immediately obvious that embeddings trained jointly with a specific objective result in models that are completely specific to the underlying task. That's the reason using pre-trained generic word embeddings is rarely a good idea. The Graphs tab shows an interactive visualization of the graph of low-level TensorFlow operations underlying your Keras model. See figure 7.13. As you can see, there's a lot more going on than you would expect. The model you just built may look simple when defining Keras, a small stack of basic layers. But under the hood, you need to construct a fairly complex graph structure to make it work. A lot of it is related to the gradient descent process. This complexity differential between what you see and what you're manipulating is the key motivation for using Keras as your way of building models. Instead of working with raw TensorFlow to define everything from scratch, Keras makes your workflow dramatically simpler. Note that Keras also provides another, cleaner way to plot models as graphs of layers rather than graphs of TensorFlow operations. The utility keras.utils.plot_model. Using it requires that you've installed the Python pydot and pydot-ng libraries, as well as the graphviz library. Let's take a quick look. This creates the PNG image shown in figure 7.14. You also have the option of displaying shape information in the graph of layers. This example visualizes model topology using plot_model and the show_shapes option. See figure 7.15. Section 7.2.3. Wrapping up. Keras callbacks provide a simple way to monitor models during training and automatically take action based on the state of the model. When you're using TensorFlow, TensorBoard is a great way to visualize model activity in your browser. You can use it in Keras models via the TensorBoard callback. Section 7.3. Getting the most out of your models. Trying out architectures blindly works well enough if you just need something that works okay. In this section, we'll go beyond works okay to works great and wins machine learning competitions by offering you a quick guide to a set of must-know techniques for building state-of-the-art deep learning models. Section 7.3.1. Advanced architecture patterns. We covered one important design pattern in detail in the previous section. Residual connections. There are two more design patterns you should know about: normalization and depth-wise separable convolution. These patterns are especially relevant when you're building high-performing deep convnets, but they're commonly found in many other types of architectures as well. Batch normalization. Normalization is a broad category of methods that seek to make different samples seen by a machine learning model more similar to each other, which helps the model learn and generalize well to new data. The most common form of data normalization is one you've seen several times in this book already: centering the data on zero by subtracting the mean from the data, and giving the data as a unit standard deviation by dividing the data by its standard deviation. In effect, this makes the assumption that the data follows a normal or Gaussian distribution and make sure this distribution is centered and scaled to unit variance. Previous examples normalize data before feeding it into models. But data normalization should be a concern after every transformation operated by the network. Even if the data entering a dense or conv2D network has a zero mean and unit variance, there's no reason to expect a priori that this will be the case for the data coming out. Batch normalization is a type of layer. Batch normalization in Keras, introduced in 2015 by Ioffe and Shegedy. It can adaptively normalize data even as the mean and variance change over time during training. It works by internally maintaining an exponential moving average of the batch-wise mean and variance of the data seen during training. The main effect of batch normalization is that it helps with gradient propagation, much like residual connections, and thus allows for deeper networks. Some very deep networks can only be trained if they include multiple batch normalization layers. For instance, batch normalization is used liberally in many of the advanced ConvNet architectures that come packaged with Keras, such as ResNet 50, Inception V3, and Exception. Footnote: Sergei Ioffe and Christian Shegedy, batch normalization, accelerating deep network training by reducing internal covariate shift. Proceedings of the 32nd International Conference on Machine Learning 2015 at this URL. The batch normalization layer is typically used after a convolutional or densely connected layer. The batch normalization layer takes an axis argument, which specifies the feature axis that should be normalized. This argument defaults to -1, the last axis in the input tensor. This is the correct value when using dense layers, conv1d layers, RNN layers, and conv2d layers with data underscore format set to channels underscore last. But in the niche use case of conv2d layers with data underscore format set to channels underscore first, the feature axis is axis 1. The axis argument in batch normalization should accordingly be set to 1. Batch renormalization. A recent improvement over regular batch normalization is batch renormalization, introduced by IOF in 2017. It offers clear benefits over batch normalization at no apparent cost. At the time of writing, it's too early to tell whether it will supplant batch normalization, but I think it's likely. Even more recently, Klambauer et al. Introduced self-normalizing neural networks, which manage to keep data normalized after going through any dense layer by using a specific activation function, CELU, and a specific initializer, lecon underscore normal. This scheme, although highly interesting, is limited to densely connected networks for now, and its usefulness hasn't yet been broadly replicated. Footnote. Sergei Ioff, Batch Renormalization. Towards Reducing Mini-Batch Dependence in Batch Normalized Models. 2017. At this URL. Footnote. Gunter Klambauer et al., Self-Normalizing Neural Networks, Conference on Neural Information Processing Systems 2017, at this URL. Depth-wise separable convolution. What if I told you that there's a layer you can use as a drop-in replacement for conv2d that will make your model lighter, fewer trainable weight parameters, and faster, fewer floating point operations, and cause it to perform a few percentage points better on its task? That is precisely what the depth-wise separable convolution layer does, separable conv2d. This layer performs a spatial convolution on each channel of its input independently before mixing output channels via a point-wise convolution, a 1x1 convolution, as shown in figure 7.16. This is equivalent to separating the learning of spatial features and the learning of channel-wise features, which makes a lot of sense if you assume that spatial locations in the input are highly correlated, but different channels are fairly independent. It requires significantly fewer parameters and involves fewer computations, thus resulting in smaller, speedier models. And because it's a more representationally efficient way to perform convolution, it tends to learn better representations using less data, resulting in better performing models. These advantages become especially important when you're training small models from scratch on limited data. For instance, here's how you can build a lightweight, depth-wise separable convnet for an image classification task, SoftMax categorical classification, on a small dataset. When it comes to larger scale models, depth-wise separable convolutions are the basis of the exception architecture, a high-performing convnet that comes packaged with Keras. You can read more about the theoretical grounding for depth-wise separable convolutions and exception in my paper, Exception, Deep Learning with Depth-Wise Separable Convolutions. Footnote. See note 5 above. Section 7.3.2. Hyperparameter optimization. When building a deep learning model, you have to make many seemingly arbitrary decisions. How many layers should you stack? How many units or filters should go in each layer? Should you use ReLU as activation? Or a different function? Should you use batch normalization after a given layer? How much dropout should you use? And so on. These architecture-level parameters are called hyperparameters, to distinguish them from the parameters of a model which are trained via backpropagation. In practice, experienced machine learning engineers and researchers build intuition over time as to what works and what doesn't when it comes to these choices. They develop hyperparameter tuning skills. But there are no formal rules. If you want to get to the very limit of what can be achieved on a given task, you can't be content with arbitrary choices made by a fallible human. Your initial decisions are almost always suboptimal, even if you have good intuition. You can refine your choices by tweaking them by hand and retraining the model repeatedly. That's what machine learning engineers and researchers spend most of their time doing. But it shouldn't be your job as a human to fiddle with hyperparameters all day. That is better left to a machine. Thus, you need to explore the space of possible decisions automatically, systematically, in a principled way. You need to search the architecture space and find the best performing ones empirically. That's what the field of automatic hyperparameter optimization is about. It's an entire field of research, and an important one. The process of optimizing hyperparameters typically looks like this. Choose a set of hyperparameters. Automatically. Build the corresponding model. Fit it to your training data and measure the final performance on the validation data. Choose the next set of hyperparameters to try. Automatically. Repeat. Eventually, measure performance on your test data. The key to this process is the algorithm that uses this history of validation performance, given various sets of hyperparameters, to choose the next set of hyperparameters to evaluate. Many different techniques are possible. Bayesian optimization, genetic algorithms, simple random search, and so on. Training the weights of a model is relatively easy. You compute a loss function on a mini batch of data and then use the backpropagation algorithm to move the weights in the right direction. Updating hyperparameters, on the other hand, is extremely challenging. Consider the following. Computing the feedback signal, does this set of hyperparameters lead to a high-performing model on this task, can be extremely expensive. It requires creating and training a new model from scratch on your dataset. The hyperparameter space is typically made of discrete decisions and thus isn't continuous or differentiable. Hence, you typically can't do gradient descent in hyperparameter space. Instead, you must rely on gradient-free optimization techniques, which naturally are far less efficient than gradient descent. Because these challenges are difficult and the field is still young, we currently only have access to very limited tools to optimize models. Often, it turns out that random search, choosing hyperparameters to evaluate at random repeatedly, is the best solution, despite being the most naive one. But one tool I have found reliably better than random search is HyperOpt. See this URL. A Python library for hyperparameter optimization that internally uses trees of parsing estimators to predict sets of hyperparameters that are likely to work well. Another library called HyperS, see this URL, integrates HyperOpt for use with Keras models. Do check it out. Note, one important issue to keep in mind when doing automatic hyperparameter optimization at scale is validation set overfitting. Because you're updating hyperparameters based on a signal that is computed using your validation data, you're effectively training them on the validation data, and thus they will quickly overfit to the validation data. Always keep this in mind. Overall, hyperparameter optimization is a powerful technique that is an absolute requirement to get to state-of-the-art models on any task or to win machine learning competitions. Think about it. Once upon a time, people handcrafted the features that went into shallow machine learning models. That was very much suboptimal. Now, deep learning automates the task of hierarchical feature engineering. Features are learned using a feedback signal, not hand-tuned, and that's the way it should be. In the same way, you shouldn't handcraft your model architectures. You should optimize them in a principled way. At the time of writing, the field of automatic hyperparameter optimization is very young and immature, as deep learning was some years ago, but I expect it to boom in the next few years. Section 7.3.3. Model ensambling. Another powerful technique for obtaining the best results on a task is model ensambling. Ensambling consists of pooling together the predictions of a set of different models to produce better predictions. If you look at machine learning competitions, in particular on Kaggle, you'll see that the winners use very large ensemblers of models that inevitably beat any single model, no matter how good. Ensambling relies on the assumption that different good models trained independently are likely to be good for different reasons. Each model looks at slightly different aspects of the data to make its predictions, getting part of the truth, but not all of it. You may be familiar with the ancient parable of the blind men and the elephant. A group of blind men come across an elephant for the first time and try to understand what the elephant is by touching it. Each man touches a different part of the elephant's body, just one part, such as the trunk or a leg. Then the men describe to each other what an elephant is. It's like a snake, like a pillar or a tree, and so on. The blind men are essentially machine learning models trying to understand the manifold of the training data, each from its own perspective, using its own assumptions, provided by the unique architecture of the model and the unique random weight initialization. Each of them gets part of the truth of the data, but not the whole truth. By pooling their perspectives together, you can get a far more accurate description of the data. The elephant is a combination of parts. Not any single blind man gets it quite right, but interviewed together, they can tell a fairly accurate story. Let's use classification as an example. The easiest way to pool the predictions of a set of classifiers, to ensemble the classifiers, is to average their predictions at inference time. This will work only if the classifiers are more or less equally good. If one of them is significantly worse than the others, the final predictions may not be as good as the best classifier of the group. A smarter way to ensemble classifiers is to do a weighed average, where the weights are learned on the validation data. Typically, the better classifiers are given a higher weight, and the worse classifiers are given a lower weight. To search for a good set of ensembling weights, you can use random search or a simple optimization algorithm such as Nelda-Mead. There are many possible variants. You can do an average of an exponential of the predictions, for instance. In general, a simple weighed average with weights optimized on the validation data provides a very strong baseline. The key to making ensembling work is the diversity of the set of classifiers. Diversity is strength. If all the blind men only touch the elephant's trunk, they would agree that elephants are like snakes, and they would forever stay ignorant of the truth of the elephant. Diversity is what makes ensembling work. In machine learning terms, if all of your models are biased in the same way, then your ensembler will retain the same bias. If your models are biased in different ways, the biases will cancel each other out, and the ensembler will be more robust and more accurate. For this reason, you should ensemble models that are as good as possible while being as different as possible. This typically means using very different architectures or even different brands of machine learning approaches. One thing that is largely not worth doing is ensembling the same network trained several times independently from different random initializations. If the only difference between your models is their random initialization and the order in which they are exposed to the training data, then your ensembler will be low diversity. and will provide only a tiny improvement over any single model. One thing I have found to work well in practice, but that doesn't generalize to every problem domain, is the use of an ensemble of tree-based methods, such as random forests or gradient-boosted trees, and deep neural networks. In 2014, partner Andrei Kolev and I took fourth place in the Higgs boson decay detection challenge on Kaggle. See this URL. Using an ensemble of various tree models and deep neural networks. Remarkably, one of the models in the ensemble originated from a different method than the others. It was a regularized greedy forest and had a significantly worse score than the others. Unsurprisingly, it was assigned a small weight in the ensemble. But to our surprise, it turned out to improve the overall ensemble by a large factor. Because it was so different from every other model, it provided information that the other models didn't have access to. That's precisely the point of ensemble. It's not so much about how good your best model is. It's about the diversity of your set of candidate models. In recent times, one style of basic ensemble that has been very successful in practice is the wide and deep category of models, blending deep learning with shallow learning. Such models consist of jointly training a deep neural network with a large linear model. The joint training of a family of diverse models is yet another option to achieve model ensembling. Section 7.3.4. Wrapping up. When building high-performing deep conv nets, you'll need to use residual connections, batch normalization, and depth-wise separable convolutions. In the future, it's likely that depth-wise separable convolutions will completely replace regular convolutions, whether for 1D, 2D, or 3D applications, due to their higher representational efficiency. Building deep networks requires making many small hyperparameter and architecture choices, which together define how good your model will be. Rather than basing these choices on intuition or random choice, it's better to systematically search hyperparameter space to find optimal choices. At this time, the process is expensive and the tools to do it aren't good. But the HyperOpt and HyperAss libraries may be able to help you. When doing hyperparameter optimization, be mindful of validation set overfitting. Winning machine learning competitions or otherwise obtaining the best possible result on a task can only be done with large ensembles of models. Ensembling via a well-optimized weighted average is usually good enough. Remember, diversity is strength. It's largely pointless to ensemble very similar models. The best ensemblers are sets of models that are as dissimilar as possible, while having as much predictive power as possible naturally. Chapter summary. In this chapter, you learned the following. How to build models as arbitrary graphs of layers, reuse layers, layer weight sharing, and use models as Python functions, model templating. You can use Keras callbacks to monitor your models during training and take action based on model state. TensorBoard allows you to visualize metrics, activation histograms, and even embedding spaces. What batch normalization, depth-wise separable convolution, and residual connections are. Why you should use hyperparameter optimization and model ensembling. With these new tools, you're better equipped to use deep learning in the real world and start building highly competitive deep learning models. Chapter 8. Generative Deep Learning. This chapter covers text generation with LSTM, implementing Deep Dream, performing neural style transfer, variational autoencoders, understanding generative adversarial networks, the potential of artificial intelligence to emulate human thought processes goes beyond passive tasks such as object recognition, and mostly reactive tasks such as driving a car. it extends well into creative activities. When I first made the claim that, in a not-so-distant future, most of the cultural content that we consume will be created with substantial help from AIs, I was met with utter disbelief, even from long-time machine learning practitioners. That was in 2014. Fast forward 3 years, and the disbelief has receded at an incredible speed. In the summer of 2015, we were entertained by Google's Deep Dream algorithm, turning an image into a psychedelic mess of dog eyes and pareidolic artifacts. In 2016, we used the Prisma application to turn photos into paintings of various styles. In the summer of 2016, an experimental short movie, Sunspring, was directed using a script written by a long short-term memory LSTM algorithm, complete with dialogue. Maybe you've recently listened to music that was tentatively generated by a neural network. Granted, the artistic productions we've seen from AI so far have been fairly low quality. AI isn't anywhere close to rivaling human screenwriters, painters, and composers. But replacing humans was always beside the point. Artificial